Hello, everyone, and welcome to MilSurp World, the podcast all about military surplus. Today, I'm joined by Sam. Say hi, Sam.
Hello.
Oh, and I forgot to mention I'm your host, Aaron, in case you guys didn't know that it was me. This is Sam's first time on the podcast, so Sam, why don't you give us a little bit of background into what you're into as far as MilSurps go.
I'm a Mauser junkie. Unlike, you know, Mike, you've had on here before, I'm kind of everywhere. I've got a couple of Argentines, I've got a Turk, I've got a German 1871, 84. I don't know, I just kind of collect all over as far as Mausers. I've got a few others, got a Mosin. I'm not really set on anything in particular. I just really enjoy MilSurps.
What got you started into collecting?
Actually, it was my wife. She probably regrets it now. But she, I've collected military stuff for a while, and she was like, well, why don't you get like one of the firearms? I'm surprised you don't have one. And I was like, why don't I?
That's an interesting startup then.
Yeah. My first MilSurp was a Yugo 2447, and of course, 8mm Mauser. It was a lot of fun. I sold it to a buddy, but it's still a solid rifle, and it's still close by, and he enjoys it.
That's good. That's good. Well, do you want to just get right into today's topic then?
Yeah, let's go.
Today's topic, guys, is a controversial one when it comes to military surplus, and that is sporterized rifles. This is going to be fun, right, Sam?
Oh, yeah.
So let's briefly touch on, for somebody that may not know, what a sporterized rifle is. This is a general term given to a rifle that has been modified in some way to make it more for sporting, which would be, in this case, hunting, or in some lesser cases, target shooting. But for the most part, these rifles will be modified for hunting use. You'll see that term thrown around a lot. You'll see sporterized, you'll see sporters, and that's what people are referring to when you see that term. Now, let's get into who does sporterizations. A lot of the time, let's go back in time here, and we'll go back into the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, up into the 60s. You have these massive amounts of weapons left over from World War I and World War II, people didn't have any use for. The countries, I should say, didn't have any use for because they were updating their arsenals. So they just have these massive amounts of stockpiles of weapons that are just sitting around. So these companies are like, well, we can make a profit using this somehow, the American way, obviously. They buy huge lots of them, and they start sporterizing them and offering them like as custom builds for the American public. And that wasn't just in America, but this is in general what we're speaking about here. So you'll see what's referred to as Bannerman. That's one of the companies that did it. Even I think Sears did it at one point, and you'll see, oh, who was some other ones, Sam?
InterArms did a bunch.
Yeah. Who did the jungle carbine, the Lee Enfield jungle carbine? That was a fake one. Santa Fe.
Super familiar with
Santa Fe. Yeah, I remember that one. Santa Fe did that one. They made a fake, quote unquote, jungle carbine. So they took a regular Lee Enfield number 4 Mark 1 or whatever it was and converted it to make it look like a Lee Enfield, is it number 5? I think is what that's called, the jungle carbine. So we know that there's large companies doing some pretty extensive sporterization. The other group that you'll see that do this are what I call the home builds, or what sometimes get referred to as Bubba. Well, not even sometimes. Most of the time gets referred to as Bubba. And Sam, why don't you describe what a Bubba is?
Bubba is an entrepreneur who decides to take it upon himself to make the rifle as he feels like it would best be to fill his needs. The downside of this comes in the fact that oftentimes, yeah, he doesn't have the best tools at his disposal. So a hacksaw seems to be his trusty friend.
Don't forget drill presses.
Drill presses, in some cases, JB Weld, in better cases, actual welding, but even that's questionable at best.
Yeah, so when you hear the term Bubba, it's generally a derogatory term. Even but it gets thrown around a lot. There are a lot of companies that did sporterizations as well. So that term, I think, gets overused to just lump all sporters together. Really, Bubba should really refer to the ones that are poorly done, mostly done in somebody's garage, mostly done by somebody that's not experienced in firearms work, and they're just trying to customize something to their need. In collecting of military surplus terms, the Bubbas are pretty much destroyed. Would you agree, Sam?
No, it's true. There's some folks that, you know, they really go through efforts to actually make sure that their rifle is properly built and done right. And sometimes they can be demeaned because of the fact that, you know, they've taken even what sometimes is just what they got is just an action and they've built it into a rifle. They get labeled as Bubbas.
Yes. And I was referring to also the company or the even you could see the guild guns from Germany that are sporters. They're not Bubbas because that's somebody that's a professional doing that work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right. So why would you do this? Why was this done? And I think the overwhelming factor of this is what we've already talked about, is that there was just tons, I mean, millions and millions and millions of guns that nobody wanted anything to do with. So what are you going to do with them? You're going to try to sell them as cheaply as possible. Or in the cases of some of the other companies we mentioned, they sporterize them themselves. So you get these people out there that are wanting to buy a hunting rifle, but they can't necessarily afford a Remington or a Winchester or something, you know, a name brand. So they're like, well, they've got these like K98K Mausers. These were good enough for Germany in World War II. They're good enough for me to shoot a deer with. They go and buy one, and this is, I'm talking like the 50s and 60s here. And you could go down to your local store and pick one up super cheap. I mean, comparatively today, these would cost between, I think it was, if you adjust for inflation, between $100 to $150. So, I mean, we're talking less than $200 for a K98K. And most likely probably less than that, even after adjusting for inflation. And that's for the ones that people respected. People didn't respect the M9130s, just like they still don't today. But so that value was still extremely low. So you get thousands or millions in this case guns available, and they're super cheap. So people that can't afford a actual hunting rifle, they're going to make one.
Yeah, what comes to mind when talking about, you know, kind of what some folks refer to as the golden age of milsurps. I went to a gun show once, and I was early on in my collecting, and I was looking for some parts, and I stopped and talked to an older gentleman, and he said that he remembered as a kid after World War II and in the late 40s, they had crates and crates of Mausers that, you know, they, as soon as they picked them up off the battlefield, they were thrown into crates and in Greece, and they were sent over here, and then they were sold off to these businesses, you know, and military surplus stores, which sold them for super cheap. And he said, you know, they were, nobody thought about them, nobody really cared about them, just because they were so common.
I guess like an analogy would be like if you had a Toyota Camry and for some reason 75 years from now they're super valuable, but for whatever reason, like right now, nobody thinks like that because it's like it's like the most common car in the United States. But something happens between now and 75 years from now, and then it's suddenly super expensive. I think the difference in this analogy, though, is that they're still making Camrys. But that's beside the point. The point is that it's something that it's the value of it currently. Nobody's looking to the value of it in the future. And obviously, who can predict the future, right?
It's true.
So, Sam, why don't you run through the typical modifications people tend to find?
Well, by far the most common modification is a cut-down stock. It seems like it's really hard to come across a rifle, a military surplus, and most gun shows. I mean, you're going to find more of them with cut stocks usually than completely whole. It can be kind of a pain too, especially because some of those stocks are rare nowadays. Just to pull one example, a lot of Argentine 1891s. They had, you know, their stocks, the forend, cut down. And those stocks are very, very, very hard to find nowadays. And when you do, they're really expensive. Another common modification is you'll see cut down barrels, you know, to make them handier, to make them easier to use, you know, easier for hunting, getting out in and out of brush. I mean, it makes sense to trim off that little bit of weight if you're going to use it for hunting. And, you know, it's a common rifle. It's your rifle. You want to do it.
Well, and I should say here that you're going to see cut down barrels more, and this is going to hurt a lot of people. You're going to see cut down barrels more on the older firearms, the ones that are very long. You're going to see like the Gewehr 98s, the Krags. You'll see them cut down more often than you will see the K98Ks and the other ones because they're already pretty handy as it is. But the Gewehr 98 is a hunting rifle. I don't really think that's going to be super handy.
No, not at all. Oddly enough, in Canada, it seems like there's a lot of sporterized Gewehr 1871 84s running around up there. And those barrels get cut down a lot because those rifles are very long and the barrels are very heavy.
All right. So what's the next most common thing we see?
Drilled receivers. That by far is something you see a lot. You see a lot of folks where they've, you know, tapped the receiver to try and mount scopes on them with varying degrees of skill and success.
Like you said, that there's properly done, and then there's really poorly done drilled and tapped receivers, and you can tell in an instant when it's been done improperly.
Yeah, part of the bad thing about drilling and tapping receivers on milserps is that right on the top of the receiver, you generally have some information about your rifle. So when you get the rifle secondhand and it has a scope mounted on it or something, in order to really tell what you have, sometimes year of production, some cases like serial numbers for the original rifle, that becomes obscured or messed up because of drilling and tapping.
That's very true. We run into that a lot in our Facebook group, which is Military Mausers.
Military Mauser Collectors.
Whatever, a little bit of self-promotion there. What's the next thing? What's the next thing we see?
We see caliber changing. Folks, they want to get out of, you know, whatever obscure caliber the rifle was in, and they want to make it, and when the importers did it, they usually did it to make the rifle more marketable. So they converted it over to a more common caliber. You have the Argentine 1891s. Some of those, when they were brought over by the importers, were converted to 30-06. You know, it's just trying to make it sell better. When an importer does it, when a Bubba or another person does it, then usually it's because they prefer that other caliber or they want it. You see a lot of 308 conversions, and you know, you get off into every other caliber imaginable.
Yeah, one that comes to mind for me is the Moss 4956 from Century that was converted poorly to 7.62 NATO. Some of the most common ones that you'll see caliber changes on are ones that pretty obscure cartridges to begin with, especially in the United States. The ones in the United States that are probably going to be the most common caliber converted ones would be the Japanese Arisakas, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You'll see those converted to all kinds of stuff. I've seen 30-06. I've seen 7.62x51.
257 Roberts, I think, was a popular cartridge for a bunch of the Type 44 carbine.
Yes, yeah, that's another one. That's a Wildcat one, right?
I don't know.
Nah, okay. So what are some other modifications that you tend to run into?
Perhaps less drastic. You have things like checkering added onto it. You know, just general carvings on stock in general. There can be some really beautiful, intricate stuff. There's actually, in the town I live in, there's a gunsmith. He has a beautiful custom K98 Mauser that he did. Like I said, he's a gunsmith. It's gorgeous. And it has beautiful carving in the stock. That's one modification that you come across. You also see sometimes folks change around. It seems like, especially with Mausers, they switch out like the safety, some of the other bolt components, just so that they can make it a little bit slimmer, they can more easily engage the safety.
The other thing I see commonly as well is that stuff is just missing. Like, there's no handguard, there's sling spots missing, like they've just taken stuff and removed it.
Weight reduction, yo.
Yeah, and that's something that happens quite a bit. Like, it's just, you'll run across something and it'll be like, well, that's just not there. So let's get into the next thing then. Is it worth restoring a Sporter? What's your thoughts, Sam, just right off the bat?
First thing, usually no. But I would follow that up with, is it really depends. I have an Arisaka, which my uncle, he served in the 80s in Korea, and he brought that Arisaka back. He died back in 2010, and my grandfather had that rifle. It was just the receiver, the barrel, and the bolt all matching up in his garage. And he said, you know, if you want it, you can have it. So I took it, and it's one that I restored. I really loved my uncle, and it's one that I wanted to put back together because I felt like, you know, that's the way he would have wanted it. And I mean, he brought it home, went through the effort to bring it. So it had a sentimental attachment for me to try and restore it. But if I tried to sell that rifle now, I had no plans to. But if I did, I mean, I would never get back the money that I have into it. Arisaka's just, it's cheaper to go out and find one and buy one than it is to try and fix one up, really.
And that comes down to the main issue with this question. It's one, how rare is the item that you're looking at? And two, what's been changed? And that's really going to come down to it. And then also, I guess three in this case, because this is an example that you brought up, is, are you doing this for value, or are you doing this for some other reason? Like, as a hobby, or like in your case, you were doing it in honor of your uncle. That's going to be your three main reasons for why you would try to restore them. Value-wise, you're not going to get your money back for the most times. I mean, there's a couple of examples, but they're very, very seldom, right?
Yeah. A lot of times you end up, you won't even break even. You end up just head first into it.
Now, an example that Sam already mentioned would be the Argentine 1891s. And it's actually cheaper to buy a complete rifle than it is to buy a stock. Am I right?
Yeah. It's, last I looked, an original stock without any of the metal components was somewhere in the ballpark of, it was over $200. And considering you can get a complete rifle in really good shape for $350, $400, it's just not worth it.
No. Now, should you? I mean, you could make an argument for, like, it's respecting the history of it. And then I could see arguments the other way of, if it's like a Bannerman gun or something like that, then you probably shouldn't restore it because it actually inherently has its own value as being a company manufactured one. But I mean, really, it's going to come down to what you want. Do you want to have a project, and are you going to work on it, and you're going to spend the money on it, and it's not going to be something that you're going to try to flip? Then yeah, go for it. Like, all by all means. But like, you just need to really be hyper aware, especially of, in the case of a Bubba, what did they change? What did they modify, and how was it done? Especially be aware that if it's been drilled, it's pretty much going to stay what it is. If it's had a cut barrel, you're probably not going to swap out the barrels.
No. And once it's been Bubba'd, it brings a lot of questions into the rifle. I mean, you should always have your rifles double checked that they're still in their original caliber. But I mean, once it's been drilled and tapped and cut down, it really brings in a lot of questions as to, you know, is it the right original caliber still? Was the conversion done safely?
Yeah, that's another, the key thing is the safety aspect of it. So, I mean, like, the main conclusion of should you restore them is, what are you in it for? Are you in it for profit? Probably not. If you're in it for the fun of having a hobby, or in the case of Sam, to honor his late uncle, then yeah, go for it. It's going to be an entertaining thing for you to do. But otherwise, probably just best to leave it as it is. So, Sam, what are some common guns that we'll see in the U.S. market that are sporterized?
Well, one in particular, the first one that I can think of is, like, the U.S. Krag. That is one sporter that I wish I'd gotten. I saw one at a gun show back year and a half ago, and I still kick myself that I didn't get it. It was a well-done sporter. It was an older job, still in 30-40, pretty rifle. But I've seen a bunch of Krag sporters, and they seem to be fairly common here in the U.S.
I would probably say there is more sporterized Krags than there are non-sporterized Krags in circulation. What else, Sam?
Mosins. Just Mosins. There are so many sporterized Mosins, it just isn't even funny. And everything from Tapco styled stocks to, I think it's called Archangel stocks with the weird thumb through thing. It's there are some that look all right, and there are some which are just makes you scratch your head and go, you put that much money into that rifle?
Yeah, I've seen some really, like, I believe my local store, one of them anyway, has an Archangel stock, and then they put a massive, I don't even know what it is, it's a compensator or what, but it's just like this giant thing at the end of the barrel, and it's like, what is this for? Like, this is an M90, excuse me, this is an M9130. This is not some, like, sweet competition rifle. This is the gun that was made by Igor in a factory in the middle of Russia. But like we already mentioned, you're going to see a lot of the Mosins, and you're going to see a lot of the Mausers. You're going to see just all walks and breeds of Mausers you'll find as sporters. Some of the other ones that are a little bit more obscure but are typically sporterized when you find them are a US M1917, right?
Yeah.
And that one is particularly devastating because what they'll end up usually doing, the back of the receiver has what they call wings, and that was there to protect the rear sight. And what they'll typically do is have those cut off, and those are not fixable.
It's so painful. It's so painful to see that.
And you'll see that, I would say, about 9 times out of 10 on a sporter. And then less seldomly, you'll see sporterized Lee Enfields. It's not really something that really come across too much in my area. What about you, Sam?
I think I come across sporterized ones more often than original ones.
Really?
Original. Really? Yeah, it's weird here. But that's where I live. No, I've been keeping an eye out because I'd like to eventually add one to my collection, but it's difficult to find one in any decent shape when it is original. And then they're chopped down, made into somebody's own version of a jungle carbine or something.
Yeah, and that is something else that I would like to bring up here eventually, but that's going to be whenever we get to the end here when we talk about values. I really can't think of any other ones that are really super common off the top of my head, but I mean, I've seen sporters of some very rare stuff, and like we said, they just didn't realize that that's what it was. So Sam, do people still sporterize rifles?
Yes, they do.
Now, this is going to be the controversial subject. Should they?
I would say, really, no. I mean, these things nowadays, they're beginning to, even Mosins are beginning to take over, you know, the $300 mark. When it used to be they were the cheap rifles. It just isn't smart anymore to sporterize military rifles. They're better to buy them and leave them as is. You know, if you want to drop money onto a good hunting rifle, either get one that's already been sporterized, find a new modern rifle that will probably, well, it doesn't have, you know, a whole bunch of years on it, and potentially making it a bit of a wild card. But just it's better to do that with a newer rifle. If you want a hunting rifle, grab a newer one.
And I should say that Sam did mention this earlier, is that there are people that get like just the blank receivers of a MilSERP. And as we said, restoring something like that is a labor of love, not a labor of profit. So a lot of the people with the blank receivers or just the receivers and like the barrels or whatever, they'll make a sporter out of it because it's cheaper to make and assemble that. And then it's something that you can use. We're not hosing those people. That's not the same thing, right, Sam?
No, not at all. I mean, those things, they were already modified beyond their original state. I have a friend, he has a beautiful Swede sporter. It's built on a Swedish action that was actually sent to Finland during World War II. So it has the Finnish acceptance mark and service mark. And I told him, you know, it'd be beautiful. It was an original shape, but when he got it, it was just a receiver. and it's a beautiful sporter now.
Yeah, so I'd like to clarify that to everybody, and I'd like to hopefully help the community at least not try to rip each other apart, is that if somebody has taken just a receiver or a barreled action and made something out of it, that's not the same as taking a complete rifle and making it into something else. That's totally different areas. And I'll just expand on what Sam is saying is it's completely not in your best interest value wise to modify a military surplus rifle into a sporterized rifle. It's just not, I guess, logical sense for your investment, because as Sam mentioned, you're going to be able to find, for the most part, most of these rifles anymore, you're going to be able to find commercial stuff cheaper than you will find MilSurf stuff. Even the Mosins, like, those are getting up into the $250, $300 range. And then you have to buy a stock, and then you have to modify the rifle. It's not going to be expensive. It's not going to be super cheap. And I have a friend of mine at work, actually, that is trying to sell his Mosin, and he's dumped a lot of money into making it into a sweet sporter. It's got the Archangel stock. It's got some other modifications done to it. And he wants $900 for it because that's how much money he spent on it. Nobody's going to spend that much on a modified Mosin. That's just flat out.
There are a lot of really good rifles, modern rifles, you can get in that price range.
Yes, for $900. And it's just, it's not happening. And he doesn't understand that. And this is something I run into, in not just in the gun collecting world, but also in the car collecting world, is that when you make something custom, you're making it to your taste. And your taste is fine. It's whatever you want, but it's not everybody's taste. So you spent $900 making this Mosin into what you wanted. That's great. But I don't want that. I want the regular looking one. So if you try to sell it to me, and he has, I'm going to want it for like $200. And to him, he balks at that idea because that's not, you know, I spent this much money on it. And I was like, yes, but that was what you wanted. It's not what I wanted.
It really highlights, you know, a problem with, you know, buying sporters, is that it's hard to find sporters for cheap prices a lot of times, because of that very fact. If you're a military surplus collector, you really don't want to pay a whole lot, because if you want to fix it up, or if it's, you know, close enough to being original that you can get the parts, and it's a common enough thing that you can find stocks and whatever else you need for it, then really you don't want to be in it too bad so that you can get your parts and have your rifle. So, and a lot of times these folks, when they do all that, they do ask a lot of money for it.
And, you know, actually, Sam, you've actually perfectly hit the nail on the head for the next topic, which is, should you buy a sporter? Like, and I mean, really, it comes down to, what do you want to do? Are you wanting to restore it, or are you wanting just a shooter? If you're wanting just a shooter, then yeah, go right ahead. I have no problem people buying sporters.
Oh yeah, they can make great plinking target rifles, and they can be a really lot of fun to shoot a rifle. You know, it's a little bit smaller, more compact.
Yeah, and I, like we said before, though, really inspect the quality of what has been done to the rifle. This needs to be double and triple checked. You need to make sure that it's in the same caliber as what you expect it to be, because that is something that has happened a lot to people, where they buy a rifle and then it's like, oh, it was 8mm Mauser, and that's what the guy at the show told me it was, and then you get it home and then it's not.
Yeah, I can lead to all sorts of other dangers and risks.
Exactly.
I've owned a few sporters over the years. I have one right now. None of the sporters I've ever gotten have been drilled and tapped. They've all been original caliber. The only things that have been done to them is just the fore end of the stock cut down.
Right. And actually, Sam mentioned this already, which was you wanted to get your sporter, if you're planning on restoring it, extremely cheap, because you need to be able to spend that money back on restoration of it. So the example I have is that there is a M1917, one of my local shops, and the only thing that is done to it was that the stock was cut down. The fore end of the stock is not there, and it has an exposed barrel, but the wings are still on the back, everything is still there, with the minus the exception of the front metal pieces and the front of the stock. So I was like, perfect. I can buy this and just buy a stock, and then boom, I have an M1917. They want $1,000 for it.
Oh, geez.
So it's like, You're way beyond the value of what it would be if I wanted to restore it, because to find an M1917 stock is pretty hard.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of folks have to get reproductions of the stocks.
Yeah, most of the time you have to settle for a reproduction, and guess what? Those aren't super cheap.
I was going to say that, you know, it can be a real pain. The Spanish 1895 cavalry carbine I have, that's the reason why it's still a sporter, is because the stock is unfindable. It has, you know, the long stock, which goes all the way up to the end of the barrel with the nose cap on the front of it. Stocks are just unfindable. And if I hadn't found it for ridiculously cheap, I wouldn't have gotten it. And it's just really difficult to try and restore something if they aren't asking a good price for it, a realistic price for it.
Right, which brings us into our final topic, actually, which is, you know, how do I value a sporter? And I really think that the big thing that comes down to it is it a quality done sporterization?
That's really key. If it's not been well done, then do you really want to take a risk on, to go back to your car analogy, do you really want to take a risk on someone's, you know, bondoed under paint job and they did the suspension themselves with their buddy using, you know, a couple of tire jacks? And
yeah. I mean, this is something, and even when it's even more dangerous, I would say, than a car, because you're having a controlled explosion happening inches from your face. You want to make sure this was done with a professional and not in somebody's garage.
That's true.
So not only do we have the quality of the job now, but there's actually some issues with some of the calibers that they've been converted to. So the 257 Roberts that Sam mentioned earlier was a very common thing for the Japanese Arisakas to be done. But guess what? That caliber doesn't exist anymore. So now you run into an issue where you have a sporerized action and it's in an obscure caliber. You're going to not be able to get much value out of that.
No, it definitely affects how much use you can get out of it. And then there's also some of the Argentine 1891 conversions. When they were done to 30-06, they didn't change out the barrel. So a lot of times people complain about their target performance due to the fact that the barrel's too big for the rounds.
Yeah, it's just a sec, sorry. Danny's trying to get in, but he's got a new phone and it's not letting him in. I think he's probably going to be a little upset about this.
Just a little.
Oh, he said he's sorry, can't make it. We'll have to leave this into the podcast for him. We'll say, sorry, Danny.
Sorry.
Well, getting back on the topic, the value of a sporter is going to come down to, I mean, it really comes down to, what are you wanting to spend on a hunting rifle? Are you wanting to spend, you know, $200 to $300 on a hunting rifle? Then yeah, go right ahead. You know, but if you're wanting to get upwards in terms of cost, you get beyond the $200 to $300 range, you're getting it into some stuff where you could actually have some pretty new, if not brand new, hunting rifles that are going to probably perform better than what the Milsurps will do for you. Because you got to keep in mind that not only did these serve a war, they've also been served, you know, for the majority of their lifespan. And some of them have gone on for 70, 80, 100 years.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I tend to err on the side of low on sporters. But I generally try to, when folks ask, I'll also say, you know, it just depends on what type of person, what type of collector you are. Most of the time, honestly, for most run-of-the-mill sporters, they top out, you know, below 200 for me. I couldn't justify spending more than that on most sporters. I mean, of course, Spanish 1916s, I probably wouldn't even spend that much on them. I probably wouldn't even get one. It's just not there.
Yeah, that's an example of one we didn't mention earlier, but Spanish 1916s really don't have much value even in the completely original market versus the sporterized market. And you do see them sporterized quite a bit because a lot of those were converted to 7.62 NATO. So you'll see them come up on the market quite a bit and sporterized in that caliber, which makes it for a somewhat inexpensive 7.62 shooter if you're wanting a bolt gun. But it's also not going to be, it's not going to be the best target rifle you could buy. So don't go out there expecting to spend, you know, $150 on this 1916 and expect it to perform as well as you know, any other rifle that I can come off with off the top of my head, like a Krag Sporter or whatever.
Yeah, you may have touched on it a little bit earlier, but, you know, the folks, I feel like when they work with and want to get these rifles, they're expecting something that shoots like fantastic, great accuracy, forgetting the fact that a lot of these rifles were pushed hard and worked hard. So they may not still retain that same amount of quality per shot.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I see we've been joined by Danny.
Finally, man. Dude, Discord is such a pain. I don't know why I have such a hard time with Discord. But, yep, I'm on.
Yay!
How does this sound? This is me talking on my new phone. I left my microphone.
It doesn't sound terrible, but it's definitely a reduction in quality.
Damn.
Well, I mean, the good news is we just finished.
Oh boy!
I'm just kidding. We were just discussing. We were at the end, towards the end, but we were just discussing. How do you value a sporter?
Okay, I could chime in on that, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
So I would say like that. There's two ways to value sporters. Like the first way is like how useful it is, just like as a tool. So you have this old chopped up Mauser or whatever, and it's like, okay, that gun is just strictly like a hunting rifle. That gun is just something that you take out, you can shoot, gun a deer with whatever. Like, it is just a device to send a bullet at that point, you know? And then it's just worth about like what other guns like that are. The second sort of way to judge it is like by how, like, would, if it's not very modified. So if you had like a sporter, but say like just the wood was cut on it and none of the metal was messed with, like a bunch of them are that way, then I would say that has like it's like a borderline collector value, because, you know, then you have a project, you know, to buy and fix up.
Yeah, that's very similar to what we said, although you brought up the fact of using it as a tool essentially, and it has lost the collectible value of it, and I agree with that. We didn't mention that. But one of the things that we mentioned that you did not, though, is that the quality of the sporterization is also a big factor.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. The quality of it, like how well it was done. I mean, you could get like, say if somebody took a K98K, gave it to this really high-end, you know, gunsmith guy, and he did a real nice job of cutting up this K98K and put some engravings and stuff all over it. And I mean, you have something that's really nice and maybe even costs, you know, a lot of money, but like who wants that, you know?
Yeah. And we got into that too with, one of my coworkers who spent $900 on his M9130 and he was trying to sell it for $900. And it's just like, nobody's going to buy your customized M9130 for that much money.
Oh yeah. I see those every now and then, like sporterized 9130s and like stocks, or, you know, something like those Archangel stocks that they put 9130s yeah. in, and yeah.
Well, Danny,
yeah, so something like, yeah,
well, maybe you can have chime in on some more of these here at the end. The so we listed common sporters as, you know, like the US Krag. More often than not, you'll find the Krags as sporters than anything else. M1917s, Mosins, obviously we talked about that, and Mausers. And I mentioned Lee Enfields, and Sam said that he sees more sporterized Lee Enfields than he does actual Lee Enfields. Is there any other models that you can think of off the top of your head?
You know, I do see a lot of cut up 1917s, like not just with the wood, you know, chopped up on it, but 1917s that have their what do you call those? Like the rabbit ears up top, like the sight protector on the sides of the rear sight.
Yeah.
Or like they do heavy like modifying to the receiver and chop up all that stuff. I see those pretty often. No, I mean I don't know which one I've seen most often. It's kind of it's like a bad memory I don't want to think about, you know, anytime I see that. But I've seen quite a few K98Ks cut up, you know, or modified, and you know, and every time I see that, like, I just think about, oh, is it possible? Could I, you know, could I fix it? Because, you know, more likely than not, it's been drilled. And
well, the conclusion that Sam and I reached, for the most part, for the question, is it worth restoring a Sporter? No.
I would say it depends on what it is.
Just for the general answer, no. Do you disagree to that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think the best answer to most questions in life is it depends. And I think it depends on what gun you're talking about, because so I have a Sporter Rescue that I am like on the cusp of having restored, and it's definitely worth it. And it's only because it's a G43, a German G43 that the wood got cut off on it. I got it for basically the price of its parts, just the price of all the parts on it. It's not like a terrible amount of money to get a new stock for it. And then you have something that's really like a high dollar, you know, high dollar gun. Then so it all depends on like the type of gun and also the price you can get it at. Because so I'm going to use the K98K again as an example. So like if you have a Sporterized K98K and say you can get it for like $200, and a replacement stock for it, you could luck up and get for like $100 or $150 or whatever. So then you would have like a complete K98K for $350 to $400, which is like a really good deal then, you know, and it's probably worth like $500 or $600, you know, even mismatched with an incorrect stock, it's still worth more than that. So just depends on the type of gun and how much you can get it for. And, you know, I see Sporter guns pretty often, and I always just think about that. Like, you know, how much does a replacement parts cost? And then do they exist? I saw I forgot what model it was, but it was the pre-World War I model of the Ross rifle. And it was Sporterized. It was cut up. The wood was cut up. And it wouldn't be so hard to get a repo stock, but the hardware, like the stock parts, like the barrel bands and stuff like that, are like impossible to find. So something like that wouldn't be worth it, just because the parts like don't exist to replace it with. So you would just never, you could never like complete that, or you could get it and it would be like a lifelong project, you know, like then one day you'd find that Ross rifle front band, you know. But it really just depends on like the price you can get it for, and you know, ultimately how much it's worth completed. Because you know, as a completed gun, it's not going to be worth as much as like a matching gun, because it's going to be mismatched. So you just have to look at how much mismatched guns go for, you know, and sort of subtract the cost of, you know, doing it. Because the tricky part is a lot of time guns are like, some guns, especially like German guns, they're like Ferraris. Because they're worth more in parts than they are like a complete rifle. And I'm pretty sure I've seen this where you could buy a complete rifle and then part it out, and you could make more money selling all the parts separately to guys that need the parts. So it depends, but it can be done, and I'm doing it. I'm in the process of doing it right now. And it's, you know, I don't mind so much that the stock that I'm going to replace is not going to be original, because it's going to be historically accurate and it's going to look great, and nobody would know if I didn't tell them. So,
right.
So yeah, that's a long.
That's a good point that, you know, that some guns are worth more in the parts. It's like right now getting a hold of a Spanish 1916 stock. I think there's one place right now that you can buy a, you know, partial parts gun for more than, I mean, for less than you can find a stock for sale. The stocks have just completely dried up on the 1916s.
Yeah, that's the thing too. Yeah, is like because I think all wooden stocks, I think all gun stocks just sort of have like a value, especially like reproduction stocks. There's just like this bare minimum that they're all gonna cost, right? Like say it costs $50 to make the stocks, they're gonna sell it for $100. So if it's going to cost the minimum of $100 to replace a cut up stock, then it's like, if you're talking about a 9130, that it's, you know, it's Sporterized, but you just replace the stock, but the guy's selling it for $200. And in your head, you're thinking, oh, it's a 9130 for $200. That's a good deal. But then it's like, okay, then $100 for the stock, and then however much money for the hardware. And then by the end of it, like, how much did you actually put into it? You probably could have got a nicer one, you know, for about the same amount of money. So yeah, it does. It depends. If it's a, like, a lower end gun, Carcanos would be this way, probably, like a Sportrice Carcano. It's not going to be worth it. 9130 is not going to be worth it. Some of the, you know, less collectible Mausers, like the 1916s, like, it's not going to be worth it. So,
yeah. Unfortunately, Danny came in right at the end, and I have to take my wife to dinner. So we're going to wrap up a little bit here. But I do have some interesting information. We have some reviews left on Apple iTunes of our podcast, and I'd like to read them here, guys.
Nice.
All right. They are both 5-star reviews. This one is by BG for the win, and he says, I'm loving the podcast. As a person who is gradually increasing my Milsurp collection and is interested in all items history, this show is an entertaining presentation of this area of firearms. We thank you for that. And this is by Wendy Howler. As a self-proclaimed internet firearms expert, I enjoy this podcast. It's informative and entertaining. If you are the least bit interested in Milsurps, give this a listen. We thank you both for those really nice reviews.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's really great to get positive feedback like that.
It is, better than most of the YouTube comments we get a lot of the times.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the YouTube comments are pretty good.
I was kidding.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, so, we enjoy our fans, we appreciate the feedback, and if you think that we're wrong in something, we don't want to think that you think we're going to ignore you. But, like, it's...
No,
go ahead.
Speaking of that, we do have a correction from the last episode that... Dan Lopez, who is also a Patreon supporter, he commented, so I have to do a shout out and correct myself for something I said in the last video, the last podcast about the FN49s.
Oh.
All right. So Dan said the Luxembourg FN49s are chambered in 30-06. The Venezuelan ones are chambered in 7mm. So I think I said that the Luxembourg ones were 7mm Mauser.
Oh, it's okay.
The Venezuelan ones that are 7mm, and the Luxembourg ones are 30-06.
Okay, there we go.
Appreciate the correction. That comment made me want to buy a Venezuelan FN49, though, because 7mm Mauser is, like, I think it's becoming my favorite caliber now. And I bet that's a sweet shooting gun, 7mm. Also, got a comment from a guy that his name is Roman. Okay, his last name is spelled P-F-A-F-F, so I don't know how to pronounce that. But he said, your pronunciation of Lischer, when you try to pronounce L in German was correct.
Well, that's good. So it's not Lick.
Yeah.
So it's not Manlicker.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Monlicker.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah. I think everyone says it's Mon. Somehow that makes it better.
Yeah,
like, because I guess it's a little too homoerotic saying manlicker,
probably.
But it's still like, Jamaican homoerotic saying monlicker. So
okay, Sam, what?
I was just gonna say, maybe it's because we're just more used to dealing with German names, so we say the German pronunciation a little bit more. Manlicker.
All that. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe. I got comment if you want me to read it.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
So a Kyle Schaefer commented, the thing I hate the most about firearms and movies is when you see people quote-unquote firing a belt-fed weapon, but you don't see the belt moving. For example, sci-fi battle LA scene with Michelle Rodriguez firing an M2, you don't see the belt moving at all. Next would be when seeing people hip firing miniguns. Lastly, after hearing the sniper one, made me think of a movie where there was a gunfight and a hurricane. Even with 100+ winds, guys were almost dead on with targets.
You know, that'd be an interesting podcast to do, is one of the future ones, do, you know, different Hollywood movie things that are just kind of annoying for gun people.
We touched on that in the last episode a little bit, but yeah, that would definitely be one we could probably expand into a full thing.
I was watching show today where in one scene It's a World War One time period show, but this guy had a bayonet mounted on his Lee Enfield. And when it cut to one of the cameras, the bayonet was half hanging off the bayonet lug. And it was just like, you're not going to stab much with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's rough, man. That type of stuff, or the gun is like semi-auto and the bolt's locked back, and then they're pretending to shoot it, you know, and they're like simulating recoil, and it's very obvious, like that, like the action's not moving, and yeah,
it's pretty bad too. when you can see them simulating recoil, because it's either usually ridiculously overly exaggerated, or it's like they don't move at all.
Yeah, I think most normally, like, it doesn't move at all. Like watch Saving Private Ryan, and those dudes, like, just, they're firing those M1 guns, like, so fast, because there's just no recoil, so they're just popping them out.
Well, Danny, I saw a couple other comments real fast off some of the videos on YouTube, and I'll just read them off real quick.
Okay.
This one was by 6.5 by 55 Swede, which I think is probably Danny's alternate account. And he said, great content. Some of these topics need to be out there and discussed. A fun topic would be to compare and discuss all of the quote-unquote small-bore Milsurp rifles, 6.5 in particular, including the Swedish, Japanese, Italian, and Dutch.
Yeah, that would be cool. That'd be something kind of right up my alley, actually, because I'm trying to collect all the 6.5 rifles. So yeah,
that would be neat. And then... lastly here on the podcast about the current Milsurp market and tips for 2019 buying, which was our number 7, it's Jonathan Akers is his name, and he commented, whenever Iraq veteran 8888 talks about a Milsurp gun, the price goes up $700.
Yeah, he's got something to that. Pretty much anytime any big YouTuber, you know, starts talking about a gun, I bet the demand for it does go up, and you just can't, but they all go up, and like maybe temporarily the demand will kind of like shoot up, but I think it kind of all normalizes, you know, just because like, say he talks about the K31 and so everyone buys K31s, eventually people will start selling them and stuff. And I think it'll just sort of normalize. Like I get what he means, but, it's always more fish.
Yeah. I'd like to end today's podcast talking about that we do. Okay. This has been a while since I've had to do this.
You'd like to end today's podcast.
I'd like to go take my wife to dinner because I'm getting hungry too. So I'll end today's podcast reminding everybody again that we do have a Gmail account for you to email us and give us some feedback. We've had 2 people email us so far, and if you email us, I will read your email onto the podcast, as long as it's nothing ridiculous. And that email address is milsurpworld@gmail.com. MILSULP. I can't spell, apparently. milsurpworld@gmail.com. MILSURP. world@gmail.com. I apologize, guys. I have had a long day. Danny, can you talk about our Patreon?
Yes, we have a Patreon now. We have 6 patrons. We are now fully funded thanks to them. So we should be putting out more content. After this one, there's going to be a couple non-standard episodes coming out that'll be kind of like feeler episodes. We're going to see what the feedback is from everyone from it, but I'm going to lean a little bit more heavily towards what our Patreon subscribers want to hear and what topics they want to listen to, because ultimately they're the ones that are paying for this now. So if you want to have more of an influence in what we talk about on the show, you know, consider helping us out on Patreon, because it pays for us to do this. So we appreciate that. It's Patreon. .com/MilsurpWorld.
Sam, do you have anything you want to bring up?
Just that it's been fun. I've been meaning to hop on when y'all done these. I really enjoy the podcasts, the ones I've had a chance to listen to. And I hope to be able to be more active and be on here more.
Yeah, you'll definitely have to come back again. I'd love it if we could get more and more people on here. I think it's great.
Yeah, and I will say that my wife and I are expecting our second child in August. So as that date approaches and soon after, Danny will be taking over a lot of the duties of the podcast as far as hosting and producing some shows. He's got, like he said, some interesting ideas lined up, so I think you guys are really going to like it. And if that's everybody's left to say, then I will say thank you all for coming and have a good rest of your day, guys.